All right, thank you kindly for coming. My name is Dustin Lang. I'm a computational scientist here at PI. So that job is sort of half researcher and half IT staff. And along with Eric, my job is basically supposed to be to bridge the computational and like computing support Perimeter provides with an understanding of research, like methods and technologies and languages. If you have questions about computing that comes up in your research, you're very welcome to come by my office or Eric's and just ask questions. And it's part of our jobs to try to help you with computing issues, whether that's using the cluster or like figuring out some computational method or trying to figure out how to parallelize a code or whatever. Basically, like, we'll try. And if we don't have a clue, we can try to at least connect to other resources that might be able to help or whatever. So, consider us at your service. Okay, so I wanted to talk about Markov chain Monte Carlo today, and in particular, kind of slanted towards how it's used in data analysis, as opposed to some of the other ways that MCMC is used. Sorry that I have like 10 slides that are just like walls of text. And then there's going to be some pictures, and then we'll move into a lab part where you'll actually get to like write the code and play with it and get really more of a feeling of what's going on. But I wanted to at least set the stage of sort of how to think about what Markov chain Monte Carlo is and what it can do for you. It is an algorithm, a really old algorithm in physics. For drawing samples or generating samples from a probability distribution. So, the idea is you have some computer code that, given parameter values, can compute a probability, and you would like to draw a set of fair samples from that distribution. The way we use this in data analysis is like this, basically. Imagine that you have some measurements, x, that have known uncertainties or like a known distribution of what you'll measure given a true value. You have a really explicit thing, a model for the phenomenon you're measuring, and that model has some unknown parameters. So the thing that is difficult about doing this in practice usually is that this model has to be generative, which means that it has to be specific enough or concrete enough that if you give parameter values, it has to make predictions of what you're going to measure at each point. Like, it has to make basically data space predictions of what the measurements are going to be. And it's actually really hard to write that down for a lot of problems. And then basically, if you have all of those things, Markov chain Monte Carlo sampling lets you draw a set of samples from the parameter space that correctly represent your constraints on those parameters. So, usually that's what you actually want to do if you're reporting the constraints on a model given some measurements. So that's basically why this is a really popular method in physics. Okay. You can think of this generative model part as a function that you have to write down that maps some parameters, theta, to some observables. And I'm going to call them t for like true values. And then you also have to know or write down this measurement process that says, what's the probability that you'll measure a value x given a true value t? So imagine it's like the true values are like voltages and you measure it with a voltmeter. That p of x given t is like the probability that you'll measure a given voltage value given that the true value is some value voltage t. So probably it scatters around the true value. Okay, so then, so a common assumption we'll make is like that distribution is a Gaussian distribution with zero mean and some known standard deviation. Like my voltmeter is good to like 0.1 volts or whatever. Okay, and then usually you end up kind of chaining those together so that you end up writing a probability of measuring values x given parameter values theta. And I should say for a minute that the notation of all of this stuff is not really that great. There's a lot that's implicit in it, where it looks like p isn't a function, it's sort of like a function that's defined by the parameters that are in it. So like if the notation looks unclear, that's because it kind of is, and there's a lot that's sort of implicit in the language or notation that is used for writing these things down. But so let's see. I'm just gonna switch to an example for a second to kind of hopefully make this a little bit more clear. So imagine that we're measuring voltages from the wall socket. I'm using a voltmeter, and imagine that that it's fast enough that we can measure it at close to 60 hertz or whatever, it's the right frequency. So we're gonna have a bunch of voltages with respect to time, and those are going to be like some sort of like sinusoidal looking thing. And let's say we have some estimate of our certainty on how good these measurements are. So now, so these are our x's, right? This is, sorry, these symbols, the collection of these x's are our data measurements x. And now, the other thing we have is we've made an assumption that the probability of measuring a given one of these little x's given a true value is some Gaussian. Let's say it's a Gaussian with mean 0 and standard deviation 0.1 volts or whatever. And then let's also say, this is basically a statement about our measurement apparatus or what the data are like. And now comes a physics step where you say, I'm going to assume a model. The model is that it's a sine wave of unknown amplitude, let's say. So this model of theta is that it's a sine wave. Let's give it an amplitude and why don't we give it, I've messed up my symbols already. I didn't want to use t for time because I've already used t for true. Okay, so where do these t's come from? I guess we have to, they're tagged along with the x values. So each x is actually a real time that we know to high precision plus a voltage measurement. And this is sort of another thing that comes up a lot. There's like sort of extra things that are tagged along with your data. And the notation doesn't always really capture them cleanly. What are these thetas? The theta is now just this value A. So what we want to, so now what we have is that a probability of this set of x's given given parameters theta, set amplitude, is this Gaussian for, sorry, this value of xi minus squared. That's what I'm basically just writing out this, sorry, writing out the Gaussian there. And then didn't plan out what I was going to write on the board exactly enough. Okay, so we have a whole set of measurements. The probability for that whole set is going to be the product of the probabilities for the individual measurements. And so it's going to be a product over all of the measurements I. This is writing out the Gaussian with mean zero and standard deviation 0.1 volts. And I'm going to make it proportional because I dropped proportionality on the exponential. So the measurement we got minus our true value or prediction from the model given that parameter. And there's the measurement error.
Negative.
Yeah, okay, good. Good, negative and a 2, right? Thank you. There were enough laughs that I hope that fraction of you are not entirely lost. Okay. So basically here we've gotten to this point where we have a probability for our data given model parameters. And that, you know, included this requirement of basically understanding the noise properties of our data and also having to write down a really explicit model of how the data values are generated. Okay. So that is where we got to, but that's not really the thing we want, right? That tells us, that's a thing called the likelihood, and it's basically telling you how likely your data are given the parameters. It's not really the thing you're after, right? You really want to be able to say, you want to give a distribution over the parameters that are consistent with your data. And that's a different probability thing. It's called the posterior. And basically, at this point, you have to be Bayesian. Which some people consider like a sort of religious commitment, but you know, basically, in order to compute this posterior correctly, you need to invoke Bayes' rule, which lets you turn the likelihood into constraints on parameters. So that involves this term P of theta, the prior, and P of x called the evidence that here we're just going to ignore. It has very deep and difficult uses elsewhere for other problems, but for this particular case of putting constraints on parameters, it's constant, so we just ignore it.
So Can you explain what you mean by constant?
Sorry, say again?
Can you explain more why is this constant?
It is, so you end up computing it by taking an integral of the top thing over all thetas. So, you know.
So it's a bit like a normalization.
Yeah, that's right. It's considered depending on on who you ask, it's an unimportant normalization or the most important thing there is. But yeah, so you know, in this context, it will be constant. So places where it, like these other things would be like model selection, like if you need to choose between two models that have a different number of parameters, then the evidence comes in complicated ways. But in this little setting that I'm treating today, it's just constant, so it gets ignored. And this is, you know, really, really common in all of the like tutorials and things you'll find on MCMC online. Okay, so basically, you know, with all of this, we're going to use MCMC to draw samples from this posterior probability distribution, which I should use proportionality signs rather than equals, which is going to be the likelihood times the prior. And these samples are a set of theta values or parameter values that are drawn from the distribution of constraints that your data put on the on those parameters in the model. Does that make sense? I'll take, like, people have questions here at this point before we move on. I know I spent a long time on this. I wanted to kind of give a more of a sense of the setting before jumping right into like the code and the algorithms and stuff. Okay, seems okay. okay, the name, you may have heard all of this before, but the name of it is almost longer than the code. So, you know, Monte Carlo is a casino in Monaco. Basically just invokes the fact that there's randomness. Chain, you know, here is actually just a list or an ordered list of states or parameter values that we're going to step through. And a Markov chain is a list of steps where the decision to jump from one to the next only depends on where you are. So in other words, it doesn't know anything about the history, it's just based on a single step. and now to add in another term, Metropolis Hastings, is a kind of a specific type of MCMC, by far the most common you'll ever see. Named by the two authors of papers that basically wrote it down and generalized it. And you know, 1953, they were doing numerical computing with, you know, machines that filled big rooms using this algorithm. So, you know, if you read the tutorials or whatever online, it's like, how to use MCMC in your work? Well, just write down the probability distributions. Like, yeah, it's in practice, it's usually not that easy. So this, you know, the step of writing down, of one, coming up with the model, of saying, oh, I bet it's a sine wave. It's probably a sine wave. Or, you know, it's a simple harmonic oscillator. That part can be really difficult. So there's this, in cosmology, this code called CAMB that basically just does that step and it's 25,000 lines of Fortran. So, you know, it's only conceptually easy. And writing down the likelihood might also take some work. Now, a thing that is nice about this work that's required is this work is basically involved, like comes down to saying, given a model and parameters, what should I observe? And it basically forces you to go through all of the steps of like how it goes from physics to observation. So this is like phenomenology, I guess. And being forced to write it down concretely is sometimes really clarifying for understanding the problem. It is, however, often a lot of work. Okay, so now, the idea of the Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm is basically this. We're going to move around in a parameter. So we're going to treat the parameters as a space that we can move around in. And we're going to move a particle through this space, guided by the posterior probability distribution values at different places in that space. So let me grab the hockey stick for a second. So it's useful to think at this point, we're moving around in this posterior probability space. So here the x's, our measurements, we're going to treat as fixed, right? At this point, we're not taking more measurements. We've got them written down in our data files, like those are constants. So the only thing that we, so basically as we move, as we change the theta value, the probabilities are going to be lower or higher. You know, some parameters are more consistent with your data than others. And this posterior probability distribution function tells you how consistent they are with your measurements. And if it's really peaked, like if there's only a tiny range of parameters that are consistent with your data, then you've put a good constraint on that parameter. And if it's broad, then you know you sort of you have your data have very little to say about the value of that parameter. Okay, so the way we're going to move around this parameter space is by using a thing called a proposal distribution. And often, we'll, in practice, people choose things that are really really simple, like a Gaussian. So if you to choose a new parameter value, take your old one and add, and draw a Gaussian random sample, roll the dice at Monte Carlo, and jump in that to that new place. And then once you've selected new parameters, compute the probability, the posterior probability value there, and then decide whether to take that step or not. So, and the magic that lets it, that lets the algorithm produce a fair sampling at the end is this step of always keeping improvements and sometimes keeping decreases. So imagine that, you know, there's some probability function, you're at one point, if you jump toward the peak, you will always keep that. And sometimes you'll jump to a place that's worse. And you'll sometimes, so, and those will sometimes get accepted. So basically, you always go uphill and sometimes go downhill, if you want to think of it as like a peaked probability space. And in the long run, this full chain or set of Walker positions are samples from that distribution. Okay, so I think, all right, I'm gonna, I'll show the code because it fits on a slide, and then I'll show a real example or like a nice animation example. Okay, so here's our MCMC function. This is sort of not in Julia and not really in any other language. It's kind of a mishmash of pseudocode. So it's going to take a our probability function, which you know here is our posterior probability function, a function that tells us how to draw a new, how to propose a jump in parameter space, and then an initial guess of parameters and how many steps we want to take, and so MCMC has this property that as n steps approaches infinity, it has beautiful theoretical properties. And you never know in practice whether you're close enough to infinity or not. So it has this like beautiful, like a combination of a beautiful theory that never applies. So anyway, you start off with an empty chain and start out by computing the probability value where you've started. And then take a bunch of steps. Each step involves saying, I'm here, where should I go next? So that is drawing a sample from this proposal distribution based on where you are right now. that gives you, that proposes a new place to go, new params new. And then you compute how good the, how large the likely, the probability is at that new place, and then decide whether to accept it or not. So basically, if the new probability is better than the old one, then you always accept. Or this is the sometimes accept decreases. So, and it's, this allows you to, that magic of using a uniform random number lets you jump to a place that's 1/10 as good 1/10 of the time. Okay, so accepting a step means that you set the parameters to their new values and your probability to the new value, the new probability. And then, oddly, or interestingly, you save the place you choose to either go or stay into the chain. So if you choose not to accept a new move, you still store a copy of where you decided to stay. Okay, I'm gonna show a nice animation from Dan Forman-Mackie. I'll give you these slides after so that you can follow that link and look through the rest of his talks and stuff as well if you like. He has some really nice and funny talks on these topics. Okay, so now what I should have done is choose a model in my example. Instead of choosing just a one parameter model, I should have put in like a phase offset. So that it would be a two parameter model of amplitude and phase. So imagine, if you will, that I decided to do that all along. So now there's a two parameter model. So what's being plotted here is, imagine you have a two parameter model along these two axes, and these contours are the contours of the posterior probability function. So, you know, meaning that parameter values here are of high probability and elsewhere are very low. So imagine this is the how things work in an ideal world. You start here. This proposal distribution step says draws a sample from these contours. So this is showing what is a really typical choice of saying, I'm going to draw that from a Gaussian. So I'm going to, you know, choose a Gaussian direct offset to each of my parameters. So propose a new position. Compute the posterior probability there. And I believe there is a typo in these slides that I've used and enjoyed it many times. They're from 2013. So I think the x and the x prime are swapped there. So basically, this decision to accept, if assume they're reversed, basically ignore the q's right now, because for the Gaussian, it's symmetric. So these two values are equal. The two Q functions are equal. So basically, whether you accept or not is based on how good the new position is versus how good the old position is. Those should be flipped. I apologize. Now the contours are only in the middle, but imagine they keep going out. Now that particular step would be stepping up a lot of contour lines in the probability space, in the black probability space. So that step would definitely be accepted. Save that new value and then draw another sample from this distribution. that is an uphill step, so it gets accepted. Sample another one, gets accepted. Sample another one. And then finally here is one where it's sampling, it's sampled off to the left there. So that's actually a worse position in the probability space. So then, you know, you draw a random number between 0 and 1, and if it's half as good, then you accept it half of the time. So in this case, I guess it you draw a random number and it comes out to not accept, and then basically stay there, move on and draw another sample, and so on. And if you repeat this many times, what will happen basically is it will climb up to from where you started way off in terrible land, following this gradient uphill until it arrives at the kind of core of the distribution. And then it basically walks around sampling different positions on this distribution. If you wait long enough, it'll take excursions down into the plains and back up. And basically over a long time, over the long haul, will like basically fully cover this parameter space in proportion to how probable it is. Now in practice, that takes an awful long time to get to the really low points. If you want to cover parts that are 1/1,000,000th as large, you spend a lot of time. Yeah. Pardon me?
Why do we accept worse probabilities?
Why do you sometimes accept worse probabilities? So if you only accepted uphill moves, that would take you to the peak of the distribution, but then you would just stay there all the time. So that would be a good optimizer, but it wouldn't draw samples from the full distribution. So that, that, if you go to the peak of the distribution, that result is the maximum, so it's usually called the maximum likelihood answer, and is often reported in the literature. If instead you want to draw a sample from the whole distribution and understand not only what the best is, but also how broad or like how well constrained it is, then basically you have to occasionally step downhill so that you can sort of explore different parts of the terrain. Okay. Good, more questions about this, thoughts? Okay, so now there's, now Dan has some slides about Metropolis Hastings in the real world, and we'll see this in the lab part. In the real world, maybe, you know, you start somewhere reasonable on the distribution. Maybe you take a previous value published in the literature and use that as your starting point. And let's say your distribution looks like that. You're in a reasonable place to begin with. So if you sample from a fairly big circle like this, you're pretty often going to step off into some bad part of the terrain. So this first proposal jumps off of the ridge, basically. So that gets rejected. You draw another one, it gets rejected. You draw another one, it gets rejected. You draw another one, it gets rejected. And so on. So that is called small acceptance fraction. And that is a problem we'll face. Another thing that can happen is, you know, imagine you initialize as before and your proposal distribution is small, so basically you're only going to take smallish steps. Then, instead of taking like 3 or 4 or 5 steps to get from there to the peak, it takes like 20. And then moving around this space takes a long time to move from place to place. So basically, instead of like moving from end to end of this distribution, it sort of like wanders around a little bit here and there. kind of only exploring the local area in some, in this, you know, limited number of steps that are shown here. Over the long haul, again, it'll cover the whole probability surface. But if you, if the proposal distribution is really small, then it just takes an awful long time to do that. Oops, sorry. I should put down the stick. So that's called the huge acceptance fraction problem, I guess, by Dan. Okay. I think at this point we should go into writing code mode. Good. So my intent was to have prepared a beautiful notebook with places for you to type in things. I forgot how slow I am at Julia. It is not a native language to me, so that took me a lot longer than I was expecting. So I am not as prepared as I had intended to be. So I think that, let's see, what's the best thing to do? I think what I'm going to do is put myself on the spot and type into a blank window. And you can see exactly how bad I am at Julia. Which will have the advantage that I'll go slow enough that you can more than easily keep up. All right, so I'm going to hop over to symmetry and let's see. Yeah, definitely. Sorry, I'm just thinking about whether I really want to type into an empty notebook, or I did sort of write out some stuff beforehand, but yeah, maybe I'll do this instead. So if you want to do the same, follow along. I'm using JupyterHub on symmetry, and I'm using Julia 1.2, but that won't really matter for anything today. If you have any problems, you can raise your hands or whatever, and Eric can come around and help you, or I can. Okay, so I thought I would first show more or less this synthetic example. So imagine you're given a data table with a bunch of voltage measurements. So that's these Y's. If you want to go to, oh, you can't see that URL very well. If you go to github.com/mcmc-notes, so if you want to check that out on symmetry, you could go. Let me make this bigger.
It'd be nice not to use a shell for that. You can create a different Julia notebook, or you can create that.
Okay. Okay, so here I am on symmetry. I am going to create a new... no, I don't want any of those. I want a console, right? Just want a terminal.
Doesn't
matter. Yeah, so... Ah, yes, thanks. So I'm going to go git clone http://github.com/dstn/mcmc-notes. Good. Notes. Okay, and I have that stuff. Okay, so now I'm going to open up that. Let's see, what do? I go to my home directory, find the MCMC notes directory, and open up that IPy notebook. All right, I guess I'll just start talking through this one. Okay, so here's our example again. Let's say our observational collaborator gives us these set of measurements. These are, you know, voltages from of the sine wave or whatever. And, you know, again, we have these like times when the measurements were taken, and we're going to say those are evenly spaced and there's no uncertainty on them in this example. So let's just plot what we were given. So, you know, it's a sine wave looking thing, although it's kind of noisy. Now, here's the part where we have to write down our model function. And the model here is like I did before, except with a phase this time. Yeah.
In the Jupyter notebook, to open the file there, how do you open your file there, mcmc.ipython notebook?
Good question. So I'm doing a thing I shouldn't do, which is I'm using a different, slightly different interface than you probably are. Okay. So basically, here I'm writing down this sine model. So the t's are there. This is I'm not really sure in Julia what the kind of nice way of doing this is, but we're going to end up passing these times around from function to function, even though they're constant the whole time. So I don't know if you should use global variables or compile them in or something like that. But anyway, so it takes these times, and then the two parameters of our model, which are the phase and amplitude, and it's just computing this thing, right? It's computing the sinusoid of the times minus the phase offset. Okay, so now, given that, we can plot this function, this, if we guess at some initial parameters, I chose phase of 0 and amplitude of 6 here, you can plot out this, what this model says your observations ought to be. And you can see that my eyeballing it was not too bad. That, you know, given the scatter on those data points, they don't look too inconsistent with that value. But we'd like to be able to say something a little bit more specific than that. So now, before we can start using Markov chain Monte Carlo, we have to write down our likelihood function. So given model parameters, how probable are the measurements we made? So I should probably here. I'm going to undo. Oh no, I'm not going to do that because I'll do it wrong. So here I'm doing it in this two-step thing of computing, of using our model function to say, with those parameters, what should we have measured? And then saying, from those true values, how probable are our measurements? So how far did we deviate from, like, how far do our measurements deviate from the true value? So this line is basically saying what the predictions of the model are, and then this like log likelihood. Oops. Is the proportional to the log of the Gaussian. So you'll very often see log likelihoods used, because if you're dealing with 100 measurements, then each of them is probably scattering like at least one sigma down. So then once you take the Gaussian of all of those, it ends up being a very, very small value, and you end up like getting numerical underflow and stuff like that. So so just to deal with the fact that you're usually dealing with a huge dynamic range, you'll almost always see things written in terms of log likelihoods. So this ends up being minus a half times chi squared of the measurements. So it's kind of nice. So, you know, basically your measurements minus the model predictions squared over the standard deviation of your noise squared. And then that summed over all of the measurements, and then the whole thing times minus a half. OK, so if you put in, you know, a couple of different parameter values, you can I didn't run the whole notebook, so I'm going to have to go and run each step. This is one of the problems with using notebooks is when you're looking at it, it looks like it's live, and then you go to do something and it's not live. And Julia is so fast that it takes forever. The second time is fast, if that's any consolation. Oh, come on, Eric.
So can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, of course.
Here now is that you're given the set of the data, and then you're trying to figure out the amplitude and the phase of the model.
Yeah, that's right.
But what the standard deviation of the noise is given a priori?
Yeah, that's right. So,
but in practice, how do you, is that like?
It usually is kind of, like there's usually, I mean, okay, it depends a lot on your field or what the experiment is, but there's often the experimentalists will have a pretty good sense of what the noise properties of the instrument are. So often, like it, if you have on the hat of a data analyst, like it usually is given to you, or at least sort of understood.
Okay. So that's not actually in the list of the parameter that we're trying to figure.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a really good question. You can actually make it one of the parameters you try to fit, or you know, you can actually deal with that as a thing that you're trying to understand as well. And that's kind of another really kind of powerful reason to use MCMC. But yeah, here I'm just going to treat it as a fixed given. Okay, finally my plot came up. So here's my sine function. Here's what the model says about it. Here's my sine log likelihood function. Okay, so now if I guess at a couple of parameters, you know, say phase is 0.1 and amplitude is 6, I get a log likelihood value. If you take the exp of that, it's, you know, 10 to the minus 3 or something. This is only for 10 measurements. You know, if you had 100 measurements, then that would be a very tiny value, and it might turn out to be too small for the computer to really deal with properly. So, you know, basically, as you change these parameters around, you get higher or lower log likelihood values. Now, one thing I didn't say is that if you're dealing with a two-dimensional parameter space, MCMC is kind of overkill, right? You could just grid up the space. It's two dimensions. So I'm going to do that here, right? I'm going to just draw a grid of phases between, I eyeballed 0 and 1/2 and amplitudes between 5 and 8. And you can just compute the log likelihood at each of those places and plot it up as a heat map, right? So these are the log likelihoods. So it's sort of, you can kind of see that there's like, that the maximum likelihood value is sort of here. But it's sort of, actually at this point, it sort of helps to take the exp of that and look at the probability values. And you can see that it's sort of like looks like it's a kind of Gaussian shaped thing around whatever, 0.1 and 6 and 1/2. But in a lot of the problems that come up in real life, the number of parameters is significantly larger. So then gridding it up just doesn't work. So then that's where Markov chain Monte Carlo comes in. OK, so now it seems like we're almost there. But there's one more conceptual step we have to take, which is to go from likelihoods to posterior probability distributions. And so that means, at least conceptually, we have to put a prior on the parameters. Otherwise, just the math doesn't work. And a thing you see all the time, in, at least in astronomy or astrophysics, is to choose a flat prior, which is basically claiming that you have no preference for a parameter value before you've seen the data. So which means that, you know, in practice, that means the prior is going to be constant over the entire range. Mathematically, that's wrong. You can't do that. The prior has to integrate to 1 over the entire range. So you're saying it's constant from minus infinity to plus infinity, so that doesn't work. But so technically, it's an improper prior, but in practice, it's fine. So now I'm writing out this sine log posterior, so it gets the times, the data, and the two parameters of our model, the phase and amplitude. First, I compute the log likelihood. And since we're working in log space, a flat prior just means that the log prior is 0. So multiply together the likelihood and the prior, or add together the logs, and that's your answer. So, you know, it's actually the same thing, but it's good to get in the habit of actually writing it down, because otherwise you can do things that are quite wrong and not really realize it. Okay, so finally, the MCMC code. And oh, not quite yet. We need to also choose a proposal distribution, so how we're going to jump around this space. So here I'm going to make another common choice and use a Gaussian with experience. So here's what the code looks like. So actually, this is where I should type in an empty window, right? Because I'm just going to go through it line by line, sorry. OK, so we're going to start with an empty chain and some initial guesses at the parameters, and also write down these jump sizes for the proposal. So this is basically how far we're going to move in parameter space when choosing how to explore this parameter space. And these were just values that I pulled out of the air. We'll see in a little bit that if you choose them too big or too small, then bad things happen. And there are ways to kind of come up with good values. But it is one of the issues with MCMC that these values exist. Like, you have to write down basically jump sizes. Okay, so given those initial parameters, we can compute the posterior. And then choose how many steps to take. Now, for each step.
Sorry.
Yep.
What's the number here? 1?
Oh, yeah. So in Julia, you can write, that's just 1,000. You can put an underscore, and it doesn't do anything. It's just like, if you wanted to write 1,000,000, it's nicer to group it in with sets of 3 zeros rather than just writing like 1,000,000. How many zeros was it? So it's just a Julia. Nice little bit of syntax. I didn't actually run up. Sorry, I should go up and run my. Okay. So each step involves drawing a sample from this proposal distribution. So in other words, we made it it's a Gaussian, so we're going to draw a rand n, which is a normal distribution sample, scaled by the jump sizes for the phase and amplitude. So in other words, we're going to choose a new phase and a new amplitude by taking our current positions and adding some random noise. for a random jump. Then we'll compute the log posterior value at those new parameters. So that's log prob new. And then here's the accept step. When I wrote the pseudocode, I said accept it if it's better or if it's worse by some fraction. You can combine those into these two, into this one statement, because if the, so this rand is a random number between 0 and 1. So if the log prob nu is bigger than log prob, then this thing's positive and the exponential is greater than 1. So it's always bigger than a random number between 0 and 1. If the new probability is half as big, then it has to be, then this comes out to a half, and only half of the time will that be larger than a random draw between 0 and 1. Okay, so if we accept, then you jump to the new position by saying, oh, my log prob is now the new one, my phase is now the new one, and my amplitude is now the new one. And then regardless of whether you jumped or not, you store those values on the chain. Okay, so I'm going to turn this back to 1,000 and run that. That took under a second. Computers are so fast. And you can see that then after running that, the chain has all of these values where these are the phases and these are the amplitudes of all of the places it explored in that space. Now that doesn't really mean much to me, but if you plot them out, you get this, you know, thing that looks like a hairball of where this, of all the places in this parameter space that you explored. So if you look at the values, it's sort of between 0 and 0.2-ish for phase, and sort of between like 5 and 7.5 for amplitude. And it seems to kind of have more, spend more time in the middle, which is consistent with that plot we made before that showed the heat map. Yep.
You already have to put the information of for those cases when you relate, no? You said you have to run this twice.
So these are, I don't actually know how to make just a dot plot in Julia, but actually that's a good question. So let's look at the, okay. So if we look at the chain, actually this one is repeated, appears twice, right? So that was one where we made a proposal and then rejected it. So then we stored another copy of it there. So in that plot, it's just going to show up as a, you know, there's not going to be anything plotted for it. And let's see, does that happen any more times here? It looks like.
Just do scan.
Looks like not very often, actually. So that's not great.
Just do scan.
Yeah, maybe. So like this, scatter. Oh yeah, that's better, thank you. Another thing you can do is do a 2D histogram, that takes longer than I would have thought. So I'm actually gonna go up and rerun my code, but now with 100 times more steps. I'm not going to do that. But I'm now going to show the histogram with 100 times more steps. And there, now we're, you can see that after 100,000 steps, you know, it's done a pretty good job of sort of mapping out that parameter space. Okay, now, usually, I picked, I guess, a poor example in that these parameters aren't really correlated. but in cases where they were correlated, it would correctly map out the correlations between those parameters.
Justin, when you set a criteria for acceptance or rejection, do you have to respect the detail balance?
Yes. Yeah, so that's a big, so detailed balance is basically part of the magic that's required for MCMC to do the right thing. And sorry, but what was your
question? Here in your rejection criteria, just saying, okay, the in your code, right?
Uh-huh.
So whether you're accepted against, okay, whether the just have to check that.
Sure.
I just say the difference in the likelihood is not in some number.
Yeah. I forget right now exactly how you show that that preserves detailed balance, but it does. sorry, that's not a satisfactory answer, but I don't have a better one. Okay, so when you are writing up your paper, then you can make plots like this, where you can get what's called a marginalized distribution or marginalized constraint on your phase. If you need something to go in your abstract, then you can take the phase samples are all of the first elements of the chain. And you can take the mean or median of the phase samples. Not like that, apparently. Oh, how do I have to using stats?
Probably. I don't know what the package is called.
Using statistics. Then I can do median. And if you wanted to, what is it? There's probably a variance or a standard deviation. Can I go like that? Yeah, so if you need, whoops. Oh, good thing I had a battery, I have a good computer. So if you take the you can do the mean or the median of the phase sample and some, say, interquartile range or standard deviation, and that's what you can write down in your abstract, that we measured a phase of 0.095 plus or minus 0.067, which is nice. Okay, so a couple of things. So let's see what time is after. Okay. So I wanted to, should we look at how to look at the step sizes and how to, should probably do that and talk about acceptance fractions. Sure, let's do that. Okay.
Was it the hypoacceptance, the problem that you
had? Yeah, so.
A few rejections. So
yeah, that's right. So, yeah, so in this. Yeah, that's right. In this set of samples, at least, it looks like there were very few repeated values. So it looked like we were kind of we were taking small steps. So there weren't very many rejections. So this was the case where like it's very, very slowly exploring the parameter space. I'm trying to think of a nice way of showing that. And I think the way to do that is to just plot one of the dimensions individually. And I'm going to switch back to only 1,000 samples. So let me do that by this, by going like that, up to 1,000. Nope. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so when you do that, so this is, I should label my axes probably, but these are the phase values at each step. So for 1,000 samples. And you can see that it's making these basically like slow moves across the parameter space. And it looks like it's oscillating, which kind of shouldn't be. It should be basically like more or less random walking around the space. And if you look at, let's see, if we look at the second 1,000 samples, you know, it does sort of look like it's, you know, more or less random walking through the space. But it's taking a kind of a long time to traverse from end to end, which means that while we took several thousand steps, each of those steps is not very independent of the one next to it, because you're forced to only move a small amount. So even though we took 10,000 samples, the effective number of samples is more like the autocorrelation time of that function. So it's sort of like the time it takes for it to move from end to end of the parameter space. And, you know, that's looking to be like at least 100. So in fact, the number of like effectively independent samples you have is like 100 as many as the number of steps you took. So that means that basically we have to take larger steps. And the way to measure that is to count the acceptance fraction or acceptance ratio. So we can do that by instrumenting the code a little bit. So I'm going to go back to my MCMC code and just count how many times we accepted a move. And accepts started at 0. And then down in the part where we decide to accept a move, I'll go n accepts plus equals 1. I should spell accepts correctly. And so my prediction is that we're going to find that n accepts is pretty large, like it accepts most of the moves because the moves are small. So my prediction is that's going to be like, it's going to be well above 50%. It's probably going to be 80% or something. So let's run that. And so n accepts was, 90,000 out of n steps, which is 100,000. So 90% acceptance rate. So that's too high to get effective samples. Now, we don't know whether the problem is, we have two parameters, right? We have the jump phase and the jump amplitude. So we don't know whether it's we're taking small steps because of the phase or the amplitude. So if we eyeball the histogram that we get out at the end, we can see the width of that phase distribution is like kind of 0.1-ish. So, and I guess we could do the same thing for the amplitude distribution, but let's just change the phase jump to begin with. So I'm going to make that 10 times bigger, make it 0.1, and rerun it and see what the acceptance rate looks like. So it should drop, right? Because it's taking bigger steps. So more often it's going to go from near the peak to somewhere fairly far down the slope of the distribution. So fewer of those steps will be accepted, but in general, they're going to be larger steps. So it's going to be able to move around the space faster. And if we plot it, I think we should, actually if we print it out, we should be able to see that there's more repeated values. So here's one where it went like four repeats in a row, there's three repeats in a row, That's all. Oh, there's
a few repeats.
And if we plot the chain, we should now see that it sort of is moving faster. Yeah, so that's the same 1,000 samples, and you can see that it's like really getting around the space more. And I think that if we show the histogram, I think we should find that it's more smooth. But I'm not sure. I didn't actually try this beforehand. Not noticeably. Maybe 100,000 steps is enough to smooth over that. Okay. So we're at 1:20, so maybe I should leave it there. So I'll say a couple more things about how you might, like, the next couple of steps you might take if you're exploring this. So in this example, we chose to jump in both parameters at once. So we sampled from that two-dimensional Gaussian. Another thing you can do that is especially helpful if you're trying to understand how to set the proposal distribution is, instead of jumping both every time, to flip a coin and half of the time step in one parameter and half of the time step in the other parameter. And then you can measure independently how many of those two accepts, like what fraction of time those two are accepted. You can measure the acceptance ratios for the two parameters separately and use that to tune the acceptance ratio. You might ask what a good acceptance ratio is, and usually people will quote you something like 0.3, like 30% of the time you want to accept a move. Depends a little bit on the algorithm and the details, but usually kind of in that ballpark is what people shoot for. Now, a couple of other, actually I'm gonna flip back to my slides for a second because I have a couple of like wrap-up thoughts. I can view full screen. So, you know, the nice thing about MCMC is you can put constraints on model parameters, including covariances. You could include but ignore things like nuisance parameters in your data analysis. Like, you might not care about the phase. You can still include it in your model, but then, you know, basically choose not to report, like not to say anything about it in your paper, but you've correctly dealt with its covariances with the amplitude in your analysis. And as you asked, if you had uncertainties about how the instrument is functioning, that's another, or like what the noise properties of, those can be dealt with as extra parameters in the model that you deal with in the analysis, but then basically just discard. And you can do that because the MCMC samples are correctly marginalized. So if you don't care about one parameter, you just drop it out of the chain, and the results still obey its covariances, but you just don't have to care about it. So, you know, MCMC isn't a magic bullet, so things it doesn't do for you is tell whether you've taken enough steps. So I sort of, you know, in this simple example, we had 10 data points, and I took 100,000 steps because I could, and it ran in under a second. In practice, if you read, like, the cosmology code CAMB I was talking about, there's a wrapper on it called CosmoMC, and it says, if you're on a fast computer, you'll have reasonable results within a few hours. If you want anything better, run it overnight or run it on a cluster. You know, so these things can take time, and it's really hard to tell whether, so this was a simple parameter space, right? It only had one mean, and it was in like one peak, and it was in two dimensions. But if you're in a higher dimensional parameter space, it can take a long time to sample around the space. And you sort of never really know whether it's reached a final answer or not. And there are lots of tricks and rules of thumb, but no really good theory. So critically, it doesn't tell you if your model is any good. So you know, I said, oh, let's fit it with a sine wave, but it could be that the actual phenomenon is not a sine wave, but sort of has a flat top. And MCMC will very happily come up with the closest model, like the closest fit to the data it can for the model you gave it. And if your model is particularly bad, that closest fit, it can be really confident in that closest fit. So it can say, a nice example is if you try to, if you have, a nice simple example is this. If you have data that look like this, and you and your model is that it's a straight line, MCMC will give you a really, really confident, very strong parameter constraint on the best fitting straight line to that data set, right? It doesn't tell you that it's any good or not. So that's like kind of always a thing to keep in mind. So a thing that, a process that works well in practice is your MCMC samples give you a bunch of parameters, and you have a model that says what prediction, what the data should look like. So what you can do is draw, like randomly choose a bunch of samples, like say 10 or 20, and make the prediction of what they predict in data space and plot them with the data. So if you do that for this model, what you'll get is that it really thinks that all of them ought to go like this. And if you plot it up next to your data, you'll see that that's just not right. So you know, MCMC doesn't absolve you from actually looking at the data and thinking about what the model means. What I've shown today, at least, doesn't really allow you to compare between models very well. Partly because we ignored that evidence integral, and partly it's related to the fact that it doesn't tell you how good the model is. Another issue is I showed this parameter space we were dealing with had a single broad mode. But if you're dealing with, and then so basically when MCMC was running, it was starting off from some initialization, climbing easily uphill, and then wandering around the peak. Now, if you have a probability, a posterior function, looks like, for some values theta, that has like a peak here and then a broad valley and then another peak there, what can happen is if you initialize here, your walker will wander over here and happily spend all of its time exploring this peak, completely ignoring that one. Even if it looks like that. So, you know, again, there's a theoretical guarantee that if you run it for long enough, eventually it will propose and accept each of the steps required to get into this and then explore this one. But you don't have time to wait for that to actually happen in practice. You know, if it has to step down, if it has to wander through a very broad, low probability valley to get to the other peak, it's just not going to happen in a realistic number of samples. Theoretically, it will get over there, sample this for some time, and then wander back, sample this for some time, wander back, and do that with the right proportion of like the right, and spend the right fraction of time in the two peaks. But that's only in the limit of infinite time. So, you know, in practice, it just doesn't work very well. And so there are other techniques like nested sampling. But
so I know the nested sampling fails in the case of high dimensions. How do you How do you handle high-dimensional multimodal?
High-dimensional multimodal space. That is why they pay you the big bucks. I mean, it's hard. So this, like, you know, this is more or less like global optimization. Like, how do you know you're there? I don't really have a good answer for that. sorry. when I give you the actual PDF of this advanced sampling methods is a pretty good notebook that has some. It goes through nested sampling and some other options for more sophisticated methods. I'll say one more thing and then we'll end at 2:30, which is another Dan Foreman Mackey also has this code named in, it's for Pythons. And it's called EMCEE, NC, which performs something like MCMC. It's an MCMC method, but it doesn't use Metropolis Hastings. It instead uses this neat little idea called, it's an ensemble sampler. So instead of moving a single particle around, or a single sample around the point, around the space, it moves a collection of samples around the space and samples according to their distribution. So it's a nice idea. And it has two main advantages. One is that you no longer have to set those step sizes or jump sizes, which is a huge improvement in life if you want to use MCMC. And the other advantage, and one probably the main one that caused it to catch on very quickly, is that it you can use multi-processing really easily with it, because it's moving this ensemble of samples, and those can all be, all many of those computations can run in parallel. So the kind of quick sketch of that is, if this is your parameter space, theta 1, theta 2, and the likelihood contours are curved or covariate like that, then what eventually happens is you end up with walkers spread along this distribution, and they end up sampling sort of, the proposal distribution ends up looking like that, so that they sort of like adapt to the space that they're working in. So it's a really nice little method, and I probably should have talked about it a little bit more. But if you're working in Python, it's a really nice package. OK, I'm going to wrap up there. Thank you.